If you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
It's society. They work for each other. They pay each other. They buy houses. They get married, make children.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
I can't wait for the episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire where all the contestants team up and they overpower the host and they share the money.
The message of Occupy Wall Street is I would prefer not to play the existing game.
We are a socialist party and there are social solutions to the problems.
Communal lifestyles, I don't know about that.
No one can tell me what to do.
Wow, you're a real anarchist.
And now we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
No words for you puppets of the West. Communism forever.
God, those communists are amazing.
Welcome, welcome to the Three Left Show. Live here back in the studio after 2 months hiatus. Not really, though. I spent it basically catching up, editing episodes of the podcast, which can be found at threelefts.news and wherever you find podcasts to stream, subscribe to, etc. I'm your host, Dan Platt. This is the Radical Left Wing podcast talk show, discussing news and analysis from a far left perspective. Three Lefts stand for anarchism, socialism, and ecology. Okay, I'll just stop. So this episode, I'm calling it Green Party Blues. So I'm back because I'm coming at you with this topic. I'm talking about the Green Party and it's basically where its strategy, why it exists, what is our justification for having a presidential candidate this year. I spent the last 2 months now just kind of the news cycle in my sphere has been Bernie is surging, Bernie is great, we can win this. Meanwhile, storm clouds of the oligarchy slash, you know, the establishment, they are lining up and preparing to cheat him out. The usual quip is that if it isn't close in the convention this summer, then they can't cheat. Well, you can cheat to make it close, and then you can finagle it. But that's my and a lot of Greens' assumption, as well as those that eschew of electoralism altogether. So first, a definition of some terms that I'm going to be using this episode. So instead of third party, I use minor party, because third kind of makes you think of third wheel, and also this that there's these two parties that are the major parties. I call them the ruling parties. They manage us as an electorate, as a population, as a citizenry. That is their role, to manage us while they carry out capitalist policy. More on that later as I go into a large back and forth argument between other left intellectuals that are more conceptual about strategy and those that are more on the ground, brass tacks, kind of like the larger response to claims that the Green Party should sit this election out or not campaign in all states, you know, safe state strategy, it's called. More on that later. Again, go through it all. The whole 2 hours is going to be that I see two major strategies when it, like, first, let's assume why electoralism. This is my case, right? The reasons for doing any kind of electoralism as a activist, as a left winger, is, you know, most, if not all, citizens are engaged in it. It's the standard normal way of participating, for good or for ill. Strong case can be made for ill. We should all just stop participating. If we did, we'd be doing different types of organizing and campaigning that would be more effective. Strong case for that. But for now, or at least as far as being, you know, the practical case, is that most people have a base of understanding that you elect people and they carry out your vision, or they are representative of movements. And a movement has to be strong enough to elect people. That's kind of how you know they've made it. It signals to everyone else on the sidelines that you are serious. that you were able to gather the, say, $5,000 to run for local office, get more than a dozen people to door knock, so on. The alternative to electoralism is a kind of a syndicalism where, you know, if we have a system of militant unions like in France, where they all strike and they can strike for a while because they have a broad base of support, then that is a counterbalance. You don't need a minor party as a vehicle. But that is why I feel that there needs to be a minor party as a vehicle for struggle, for working class politics. Because certainly the Democrats are not working class politics. As we'll go into it, many Democrats are conservative. In many cases, in some places around the country, because of one party rule and monopoly, you have many who would otherwise be Republicans are registered Democrat. And that shows up and creates really weird results when looking at the data in terms of who's voting for who and why. Da, da, da. So I think that's good. So two overall strategies. So assuming like electoralism is on the table and it's worth doing, because even if you're not going to win, I do it because it's a great outreach tool. People are sensible enough to like, oh, you're running for office. Well, that's a good reason to knock on my door. Maybe it's a better case to even knock around and say, hey, I'm organizing tenants for a tenant union, or I'm organizing workers. What kind of worker are you? Maybe that would be better. So yeah, so I'm a little back and forth, but I like making the case for everything and letting you decide, optimistically speaking. The two-level strategies, if you go to electoralism, is the kind of, I find problematic, to use the term, the inside-out, inside-outside-in kind of approaches. I don't actually think that terminology is accurate, but I'll go into that. But it's to, there's the, the inside-out, which is you work within the ruling parties, you meld into them, and step three, make things better, generally better, by passing reforms, compromising within the party, and assuming that the party you meld into has a majority. So that has been in New York State what DSA and Democratic Socialists have done. You know, they elect 10 legislators to the Senate or Assembly, and they influence the discussion. They have a seat at the table in a way that the Working Family Party likes to think they do. But my imposition is that you get crumbs and you're not really making a lot of progress, because for something that you make better, 10 things get worse. Now, to me, there's the revolutionary approach where you work outside of all ruling institutions, and that includes elections. So you work outside completely. So you just organize against the system itself. You organize people based on what they do, where they live. And not any other kind of broad, and if there's any broad values, it's that we value meeting people's needs, community, the more commonalities, actually, than the team sports, if you're going to look at it that way. Politics are dumb, but they are important. So you build a replacement for these institutions. Instead of elections, you know, you build up assemblies in one's neighborhood. Eventually, you don't need the state. That's the theory anyway. Now, I consider the Green Party to be a middle ground between these two poles, to be a radical reformist, that you work inside the ruling institution by participating in elections, but otherwise, you are independent of the ruling parties. You're playing their game, but you're not doing it to all of their rules. Because even when you say are a left of center, a progressive Democrat, once you're in office and in the assembly, legislature, whatever, or even president, you're still playing by capital's rules. You're still hamstrung by what the agenda of the state is, what the purpose of our government is, which is to encourage economic growth and all the rest. Keep costs under control, so on and so on. And I figure that, you know, when you're a Green Party, you can do both. You can use the party vehicle almost as a vanguard party to do other types of organizing along with elections. Because since you're independent of the major parties, elections and taking office isn't all you do. You can participate and buffer and support more independent, more militant movement and organism. Class struggle, poor people's campaign, that kind of stuff. So that's my theoretical basis kind of preface, introduction to a number of basically long-standing arguments between different sides of the left. Now, I'm going to start with two pieces that are more like the case for minor parties themselves. The first one I think is kind of hollow, and I'll explain why later, once I'm done with it. Because this is, first and foremost, a reading hour. I read pieces, I react to them. Simple format, right? So this is from a site called The State Press, and it's opinion piece, like it usually is. Don't be afraid to support third-party candidates in 2020. The two-party system isn't for every student, and there are other options. So this is aimed at students. When students think about U.S. politics, they typically think of the Democratic and Republican parties, but there are more options. However, supporting any candidate outside this two-party system can seem useless, as it is often said that supporting any party outside this threshold is a waste. It is necessary that this narrative be challenged, because if it goes unquestioned, it remains a dominant narrative. Mind prison, as it were. Students shouldn't hesitate to support third-party candidates, because as the next generation, they can be the ones to radically change the way the political system works. The more people that support something, the more traction it has. And then it becomes a circular argument that no one votes for the third parties because they can't win, and they can't win because no one votes for them. And no one donates to their campaigns, no one is a member of the party itself. But you break that circular chain by doing something else. This idea that voting for a minor party is a wasted vote is more so a narrative that perpetuated by the ruling parties to keep them in power longer, says David Hellman, a second-year master's student of justice studies, president of the College Libertarians. Personally, since the 2016 presidential election, I felt that I will never be able to support either major party because their views seem too similar. For example, President Obama deported more than 5 million people. Additionally, Republican President Trump has deported a little over 500,000 since 2017, according to the Wall Street Journal, and has raids planned to deport even more. These actions of both parties impact ASU's undocumented, so that's the college this is being published by, and DACA students. Linked article, The Real Cost of DACA, ASU DACA students face financial and emotional costs. Continuing, on issues which deeply affect people's lives, it would seem as if there was no major political difference between two parties, including the issue of immigration. It's very important to us to vote for people we believe in rather than voting for who we think might be slightly less terrible, says Hellman. Some of the more prominent third parties are Libertarian, The Green, and the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Candidates of these organizations provide a different perspective that have mobilized hundreds, if not thousands of voters, and each have very distinguishable platforms. They are, in fact, different. But there are commonalities in places to work together, called cross-reach, at least a friend of mine did. The difficulty of a third party achieving success can be blamed on constitutional design, and so parties understand that there is more to win than just an election. Minor party candidates promote an alternative ideology for the 40% of voters who want a third option outside of the major parties, which a stat I see all the time. 40% want more options. So why don't we get higher vote totals? General answer is we don't have the advertising budget to let them know we're around when we have a candidate. This requires public financing. This requires mass membership of our parties. So even if you don't see any candidates in your area, you should give to a national or state organization so that they have the budget to eventually organize in your area. And of course, there's no better person to start than yourself. But that requires reaching out. And conversely, minor parties need to do outreach too. And there are many constraints to doing that. Like I said, you need resources. Time is money. Money is time. But sending out Facebook ads really helps. But Facebook has been really, really bad in letting us actually advertise. Some minor party campaigns, and again, I'm using minor party in lieu of third party, serve to make voters understand that change does not have to come slowly at the hands of reformism and electoral politics. So minor parties, even though they're doing electoral campaigns, aren't necessarily, and I'm speaking of myself, doing an electoral campaign. It could be an issue campaign, but the election is a great platform for getting the issues out, which is kind of why Bernie Sanders ran in 2016. He wasn't running to win. He was running to outreach with his agenda, which really got people dander up. These parties instead promote a mass movement of people fighting for their own rights instead of letting disconnected elite politicians decide what's good for them. Top-down approach. These are the people now that are saying, for whatever reason, that the Republicans and Democrats don't represent them anymore, and I think that they deserve representation. Presidential elections are the time when students can campaign and actively rally around issues they care about. Despite being accustomed to the two-party system, students need to acknowledge its downfalls and be more open to supporting minor parties that could better represent them politically. And that's exactly what I was thinking when I joined the Greens back in, it was 2013. It was after I had given the Democrats their third, fourth, and fifth chance, not a second chance, because their second chance was 04, their third chance was 08, and their fifth chance was 2010. You know, they lost the House, and I'm like, they had power. We elected the Democrats. I voted for it. And they didn't undo. Only through executive action was a little bit of the Bush administration's evils undone. But it was all done in a way I knew was temporary. Because executive actions, as we've seen with Trump, can be just reversed. Like that. Like air. So next, the usual other objection that is bandied about is a myth at this point. It's a myth. Is the third-party spoiler argument. So here is an op-ed from Truth Out, which is interesting because they also publish Tax on Greens. But hey, that's fairness that a good publication has. So an op-ed by Matthew Heidemann. Sorry for the pause. I'm here. History and polling data show third-party candidates have rarely spoiled presidential elections for Democrats. Just speaking from a left-of-center perspective here. With the 2020 presidential primaries in full swing, a common narrative in U.S. politics has resurfaced. It always does. Recently, former Secretary of State, former Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton, suggested on the podcast Campaign HQ that the current candidate Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii is part of Russian efforts to influence the 2020 presidential campaign election. While Clinton did not directly mention Gabbard's name, she insinuated that the congresswoman is the favorite of the Russians and that Russian operatives are, quote, grooming her to be a third-party candidate, like a serial abuser grooming a child, like a Catholic priest. On the same podcast, Clinton made similar remarks about Green Party candidate Jill Stein, to whom she referred as a Russian asset. And her language literally was like, oh, of course, it was obvious. These allegations constitute the latest incarnation of long-standing concerted efforts by neoliberal Democratic partisans to construct and perpetuate a narrative in which minor party candidates represent spoilers in their elections. In modern U.S. history, only a handful of third-party candidates had a strong showing, and only very few of them could be accurately characterized as spoilers. Now, this is a anti-spoiler argument article. It's not really, it's kind of a backhanded compliment, kind of saying we're not relevant enough to spoil the election. So, I'm keeping that in mind. But particularly, we're going over the history, especially the recent history. The most successful third-party run in U.S. history, though, occurred in 1912, when former Republican Theodore Roosevelt, Teddy, ran as the Bull Moose Party candidate. That is what it was called. Roosevelt came in second because it was called that because that was just, it was his party. That was a political movement, progressive movement, that coalesced around him running and challenging the two parties at the time. He came in second, winning 27% of the popular vote and 88 electoral college votes. So he won full states. It can be argued that he effectively spoiled the re-election of Howard Taft, who came in third with only 23% of the vote. So in that case, he spoiled it by actually getting more votes than him. It wasn't just, well, they would have voted for Taft otherwise. Another notable third-party challenger was Alabama Governor George Wallace, who ran as the, what it was called, the American Independent candidate in 68. Wallace won 13% of the popular vote and 46 electoral college votes. As a staunch segregationist, Wallace did not detract from Democratic candidate Hubert Humphrey, but actually siphoned votes away from Nixon, who still managed to win, mostly by harnessing Wallace's Southern strategy, co-opting much of his racial dog whistle rhetoric. That rhetoric being the law and order candidate. So when I hear law and order, to me, it's a racist dog whistle. Because who is a threat to law and order? It's the poor people, the minorities. Scary. A more recent example of a considerable third-party challenge is Ross Perot's run as a centrist independent candidate in 1992. But again, rather than being a spoiler for the Democrat, Bill Clinton, who won the election, it could be argued that Perot's close to 19% of the popular vote actually detracted from incumbent George W. Bush, H.W., and thus helped Democrats, even though Perot did not receive any electoral college votes in the first place. Yet, in recent decades, establishment Democrats in particular have time and time again invoked third-party spoiler argument as a means to justify their shortcomings. Many Democratic voters still believe that Green Party candidate Ralph Nader cost Al Gore the election against Bush Jr. in 2000. Democratic pundits, operatives, media strategists, who are all careerists, I will mention, continue to feed this narrative to this day. Their jobs depend on it. Likewise, Green Party candidate Stein is often vilified for having siphoned votes away from Hillary Clinton in 2016. But many believed Hillary Clinton to be a shoo-in against celebrity billionaire Trump. They were so confident they didn't really campaign. And it was around, and this is where I have the confidence in my assumptions about the coming year and why I have my positions. Because generally, I don't use the I told you so rhetoric. It's condescending. I don't like it. I don't like it when others do it to me, so I don't. But the people I listen to and opinions I take in and the takes I have at certain times bear out more accurately than those that are arguing against my positions. So, example that I'm getting to is I pretty much assumed that Trump would win between September and October of 2016. While many were maybe starting to pour clutch and sweat a little bit and be less confident that Trump was, of course, going to lose, how could he possibly win? Basically, after the Democratic convention, I was like, he has a good chance of winning. Like, it's the Democrats are, like, it's theirs to lose. It's not really about him winning. It's about them losing. And they are, based on everything that they've done this year and in the past, that's why I'm a Green, they're losers. That's my take. And there's really little you can do to change that. Bernie-crats have done their damnedest to get a shoo-in, to meld in with that strategy, and they're rebuked or their work is undone every time. It is being undone right now. As Tom Perez, head of the DNC, is stacking all the necessary people in the necessary places to overturn the election, whatever the results are, in the favor of not Bernie. Okay, back to this article. While the third-party spoiler argument is highly persistent in our culture, the data does not support it. Studies compiled at the Roper Center for Public Opinion at Cornell, that's here in New York, show that in recent presidential elections, between 7 to 11% of registered Democrats abandoned their party and voted for the Republican instead. Like in 2016, 8% of Democrats voted for Trump, while the third-party candidates Stein, Gary Johnson, and even McMullen combined received 5%. Democratic-leaning corporate media outlets quickly argued that in the key battleground states, Trump only beat Clinton by tiny margins, and that Stein's votes would have covered her loss. But this is a highly presumptuous argument, which assumes the Green Party voters would support Clinton by default, when in actuality, these voters were highly unlikely to vote for Clinton in the first place. The average Green Party voter, myself, who is generally much more ideological than average Democratic voters, oh, so much so I have my own talk show, rarely crosses party lines in a presidential election. By the same token, it is actually more likely that Libertarian candidate Johnson, who received 3.3% of the popular vote, three times as many votes as Stein, plucked away more conservative or Republican-leaning voters, thus actually detracted from Trump rather than spoiling it for Clinton. And while it may be enticing for Clinton supporters to believe that those 8% of Democrats who voted for Trump could be largely attributed to Bernie-crats, this argument is rather unsustainable. Again, not supported. Why? As previous voting data in previous election cycles show that this percentage of Democrats always vote for the Republican. In 2004, 11% of Democrats voted for George Bush over Kerry. In 2008, 10% of Democrats voted for McCain over Obama. In 2012, 7% of Democrats nationwide voted for Romney over Obama again. But perhaps the most convincing argument against the spoiler narrative, just that on its own, is reflected in the infamous election of 2000. Some Democrats still blame Nader for costing Gore the election. But again, 11% of Democrats voted for George Bush nationwide. Nader also received close to 3% of the popular vote with no electoral college votes. Simple arithmetic shows that the numbers of rogue Democratic voters who backed Bush outranked Nader's total tally four times over. Again, looking at Florida individually, 200,000 Democrats voted for Bush over Gore, while Nader won 100,000 votes, half that. Again, the number of Democrats who crossed party lines outflanks the Nader votes by more than twofold. Nader was hardly the spoiler. Now, this article and nothing else ahead in this show will talk about, like, why is there this 10% of Democrats that always seem to vote for Republicans, roughly. In certain areas, thanks to gerrymandering, you don't have a voice in any election unless you're a Democrat or a Republican, one of the other teams. So you have a lot of conservative people who are registered Democrats because otherwise they would have no poll. Because there are conservatives in the Democratic Party, they have a poll in primaries to ensure that the Democrats that are elected lean right, that are more conservative. So you have a party, big tent party, that's half conservative. So overall, the Democratic Party is center-right. Bernie-crats are center-left. They're a completely different kind of sub-political milieu, right? Not the same. Trends I see going forward for this year are, let's say the Bernie-crats are completely successful. Bernie's the nominee. Bernie beats Trump. There's an article that I found that actually goes into that. So put that in the pocket. Listen to a future episode, probably three episodes from now. Maybe I'll actually do it next week. Another possible trend is Bernie is cheated out of the primary again, and more and more people just move away from elections altogether. The minor party argument, my fear, is not strong enough to keep people doing elections, even as an independent outsider organization. Everyone will just go to outsider organizing, which I'm totally cool with. Totally for. I want to do more of it myself. And the DSA, there'll probably be a struggle to, either the leadership will finagle things to keep the DSA as a, well, we do campaign for Democrats when they're progressive enough organization. And if they do that, then all of the DSA's new members will probably leak out into more militant organizations. Probably like the Black Rose, which is an anarchist federation. The IWW, if they're just to do worker organizing, and so on. Non-minor parties altogether. The Socialist Party of the U.S. doesn't really run people for office, so they count as that. And there are always arguments that the Green Party shouldn't really be doing electoral stuff, but just be doing as a political organization, outsider organizing, don't worry about elections. Raise money and build urban farms and organize tenants and all that stuff. Indeed, spoilers in U.S. presidential elections, but in most cases, they are not their minor party candidates, but rather Democrats themselves, their own worst enemy. Not only does the DNC put its thumb on the scale to determine their nominee, as they infamously did in 2016, but nearly a tenth of Democratic voters regularly ditch their party affinity and cast their ballots for a Republican candidate, as they have done in recent elections. Given these numbers of rogue Democratic voters, not really rogue, but whatever, considering the fact that a third-party candidate has rarely received any Electoral College votes, at least in our lifetimes. So that's a backhanded compliment. It's a diss. It is time for Democrats in particular to abandon minor party spoiler arguments once and for all. So this is coming from a place of, stop blaming minor parties. They're not the issue. Just work on making the Dems a party that can actually win elections and be progressive. So this wasn't a case for minor party work, but just against blaming minor parties for the failings of a major ruling class party. Interesting. Okay, I got good energy today. Good energy. Good. So the last 20 minutes of this hour, I'm going to wrap up first half of this with this is an inciting incident, as it were, in my circles. Howie Hawkins, presumptive Green Party presidential candidate. He ran for governor three times now here in New York State and gotten more votes each time. And we have had maintained ballot status as an official party that you don't have to write in or petition as an independent candidate, which is very hard. More on that later. He recently wrote Christmas time, the last year, that the Greens are not the Democrats' problem. He essentially made the argument that I just covered with that article from a non-Green, that if the Democrats suck, you need to work to make them suck less. Stop blaming us. There's really no argument for it. The numbers don't bear it out. All you have is presumptions about what would happen otherwise. And you'll see a bit of that here from ZNet. An open letter to the Green Party about its 2020 election strategy. Now, some notable people have signed on to this letter. Namely, I'm going to list them out. Noam Chomsky, Bill Fletcher, Barbara Enderich, Kathy Kelly, Ron Daniels, Leslie Craig Kagan, Norman Solomon, Cynthia Peters, and Michael Alpert. Now, you may not know who any of those are, or you may only know who the first one is. They're all left-wing academics who are fairly important luminaries of their fields. They create the theoretical basis of the left here in America for the last 40 years. And they're all roughly boomer or older. Chomsky is a pretty old man now. And for the last 30 years, they have kind of, at least electorally speaking, when it comes to elections, their advice is vote strategically, vote based on context, but kind of boils down to lesser evilism. A vote for the lesser evil. We want the less to be choice because we're thinking about things rationally. What is the best? How do we define success as well? And so Green Party activists and other kind of leftists have different versions of success, and that matters. Just as, like, say, between working inside the major party, you know, success is passing reforms that I personally consider milquetoast and not all that helpful in the long run, even if in the short run, they are helping some people. For example, classic, you know, this is an example I think everyone can understand. So the justification that Obama presidency was still better than, say, a Romney or McCain presidency is we got Obamacare, which was the Republican health care plan. So I'm not sure how that's a strong argument, but let's say other executive orders of Obama's that helped small groups of people, you know, 100,000 here, 10,000 there, benefited from Obama administration policies. But for every bit of people improvement that there is, there are steps backwards. Or 10 times more people are harmed. That's my observation. Like certain wages could go up in this sector because of subsidies passed by Democrats. But then overall, wages are stagnant, careers are ended, or careers can never start in the first place. This is the reminder I give to anyone over 60 that wants to talk about how great or better Obama was. I'm like, well, it was in his administration that I couldn't, basically my prospects out of college were nil. And you can blame the Republicans, but you cannot blame the Republicans for everything when they held power. They won the elections. They won all the elections. They even had a supermajority in the Senate. For a brief time, but still, a good majority in the Senate. And they still couldn't pass anything that would help me, to speak in a selfish manner. But not just me, but millions upon millions of others. Tens of millions, hundreds of millions. Half the country is poor, is now poor, has gotten poorer. What do these improvements mean? Okay, so I'm going to run out of time, but this letter isn't too long. So this is a group letter. Maybe just Chomsky wrote it and the others signed on. These are people that I consider heroes. These are people I quote verbatim. I will read their own stuff on this program even. Michael Albert, Paracom, I'm a great fan. They give the theoretical framework to talk about many, many things. But that is kind of what they do. They operate in the theoretical and the conceptual. And I think that's their shortcoming and why they shouldn't really talk about left-wing strategy and kind of leave it to those in the trenches organizing the campaigns. But let's read out what they are saying and the arguments they're making, and then the next hour I will go through responses that green activists, people I interact with, have. As the 2020 presidential election approaches, the Green Party faces the challenge of settling on a platform, which is now post-capitalist, by the way, choosing a candidate for president, and deciding its campaign strategy, as if all these things are done in that order, or like they're done in summertime or something. Anyway, these things are already done. They were decided last year, more or less. In that context, Howie Hawkins, a contender for Green Party presidential candidate, recently published a clear and cogent essay titled "The Green Party is Not the Democrats' Problem." It represents a precedent Green Party stance which may guide Green campaign policy. Well, essentially has been our policy for quite some time, but Howie likes clarifying it for people. We agree with much, but find some ideas very troubling. I think a problem the Green Party has had in the past is that we've had a muddled message about what our strategy and what we stand for is. I think we've gotten a lot better with that. Any organization needs to do that well. Otherwise, it's like, well, what are you for? And it can be easily confused. Somebody says something inaccurate about you, and it's believable. If you're really strong about what your strategy is, then words can't be put in our mouth, which, unfortunately, this does. But let's read it out. The stance offered in Hawkins' article says, quoting, "The assertion that the Green Party spoiled the 2016 elections is a shallow explanation for the Democrats' losses. First, that in 2000, quoting, the Supreme Court stopped the Florida recount. That many factors elected Trump in 2016, including black voter suppression. Comey publicly reopening the Clinton email case a week before the election. $6 billion in free publicity for Trump from the commercial media. And a Clinton campaign that failed to get enough of its base out. And then the Electoral College, which gives the presidency to the loser of the popular vote. That most Greens are furious at the Democratic Party that joins with Republicans to support domestic austerity and a bloated military budget and endless wars. Quote, that the Green Party's Green New Deal science-based timeline would put the country on a World War II scale emergency footing to transition the economy from zero greenhouse gas emissions, 100% clean energy by 2030. That is our Green New Deal. When we declare a climate emergency, that is what we should be talking about. The Green Party wants to eliminate poverty and radically reduce inequality, including a job guarantee, guaranteed income above poverty, affordable housing, improved Medicaid for all, lifelong public education, pre-K to college, and a secure retirement. And finally, the Green Party strategy is to build the party from the bottom up by electing thousands from municipal and county offices, state legislators, and soon the House as we go into the 2020s, talking about the decade as a whole, not just this year. It's the aspiration. We agree that many factors led to Democratic Party losses. Now, this is the group speaking here. And that the Supreme Court was a big one, as well as the Electoral College. And we, too, are furious at the Democrats joining the Republicans in so many violations of justice and peace. Likewise, we admire the Greens' Green New Deal and their justice commitments, and also support a grassroots local office approach to winning gains. So with all that agreement, why are we sending a critical open letter? The stance the article presents, which may guide the Green Party campaign for president, it does, but they're being accurate in that, you know, he's not the candidate yet. So this is, again, quoting Howie in his article, which I'm not reading in full, but these parts are good enough. To hold other factors constant and focus on the Green Party as a deciding factor is a hypothetical and also a logical fallacy because it assumes away a factual reality. The Green Party is here to stay. So when Howie Hawkins says we're here to stay, it's because this is a response to a lot of hypothetical, you know, assumptions and the presumptions that we can sit an election out. You know, that we can, like, it's, this is too, Trump's too dangerous. We have to take a break. We have to not campaign this time. And join Bernie. Register as a Democrat. This stance also says that the Green Party is not why the Democrats lost to Bush and Trump. But even if true, well, it is. But, okay, even if true, that wouldn't demonstrate it why it won't this time. Okay. Well, you make predictions based on previous experience. That's how science generally works. Like, if I drop the apple 3 times and it hits the floor, does that give a reason why it may not drop the floor this, drop, it may not drop this time? Because Trump is president? You gotta make a stronger argument for why the apple won't fall to the floor. Let's see. However, our finding, Green policy, a factor in Republican victories, in no way suggests that the Green Party should disappear, and our focus on factors within our reach to easily correct, which would be the Green Party role in contested states, is in fact sensible. So the general argument is called the safe states strategy. Let me go further. So they basically repeat the thing that Jill Stein's votes went to Clinton in battleground states, Clinton would win. This is, again, a presumption. I have friends who are not as partisan as me, but when Clinton wouldn't disavow fracking and was still pro-fracking, they confided in me, just over personal conversation, that they weren't going to vote for Clinton. Stein was simply an alternative to not voting at all. So, it's a presumption that there is a well, again, the language, I'm going to repeat this later because I'm just going to use the language, that votes are like poker chips. There's so many chips and they move around the table. That's not how people work. Finally, if these votes did indeed erroneously believe that it was immoral to contaminate themselves. Oh, yeah. So, let's see if he quotes Howie on this. Oh, yeah. Similarly, Stein voters, like myself, did indeed erroneously believe, I don't think it's erroneous, that no harm could come from casting a vote for Stein in a close state, in a close election, that also to some degree was surely a result of Green campaigning, insisting that Green voters bore no responsibility for the 2000 election result. So they're still saying that we were responsible for the 2000 result. Not the ending of the recount, not the scuttlebutt, not for Gore being a wimp. Okay. I don't know why they still hold to that. So that's where it's like, oh man, you're not making any sense. Stant says, the Green Party is not going back to a safe-space strategy. We did it in 2004, and it meant foregoing running in contested states where the Green votes could swing the outcome. Has happened in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, you know, saying that we swung the election. Why reject a safe state strategy? Apologies to Mr. Chomsky. Greens tell Democrats, stop worrying about the Green Party and focus on getting your own base out. We agree on the importance of Democrats getting their base out, starting with nominating Sanders or at worst Warren. But how does that warrant the Green Party risking contributing to Trump winning? So again, they're presuming risk, which they need to show is measurable and that is real. Because the arguments we make is that there is no risk. I guess the argument is that if all us left-wingers, all right, who are not centrists, we're not center-right, not Democrats, we're not even liberal, but if we work for liberals, we can help them win. But what does that do for us? What does that do for poor people? For 40 years, it has done nothing. So that is why it's upsetting to hear from such strong lefties, anti-imperialists, whatever, that we just got to work for liberals because they have a chance of beating the right. Well, we're going to make the argument, well, Howie does, as a response to this, that the left should fight the right, not the center. The center can fight both of us as they do, but we need to be our own side. If you're left of center, you're on the same side as me. I'm on the same side as yours. The center is not on your side. The right is definitely not on your side. But neither is the center or the right of center. They say Bernie is too far left to be electable. They don't believe their own lying eyes. But it's more than that. It's a bias. It's a bias they have. It also means demonstrating the alternatives to whatever bias exists. And that requires work on our side, the left side, which includes the Green Party. It includes a host of other organizations that are independent and who don't work to elect Democrats, that are just there to campaign for Bernie because he, for his career, has been independent. And that's an argument I pay attention to. I accept it. I agree with it. So to conclude from Chomsky, is the Green candidate running for president after the summer really going to argue we shouldn't vote for Sanders in contested states, not just to end Trumpism, but also to enact all kinds of important changes, including urging and facilitating grassroots activism and thereby advancing the Green program? You know, voting Bernie advances the Green program. I don't know if you've read the Green program. It's actually further left than Bernie's. It's not the same thing. We offer this open letter in hopes of probing discussion on the issues related. Well, boy, howdy, they sure did. Okay, so I'm going to hit it, go to break, and I'll be back on the other side with the Green activist response.
On the day all the Democrats won, did you sigh and say our work is done? Did you feel at all angry or shocked that that all your dreams could fit in a box. And on the day that they took back the house, did the homeless find shelter at last? Was it one man who stole their dignity? Or all those laws that the Democrats passed? And the day that they counted the votes, did you drive your car to the polls? Did you think that the wars would just end if we elected a few different men? When they told you this time things would change, did you feel hopeful or mostly afraid? And what made you think it was true after the lies that the last ones told you?
All right, welcome back. This is the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, Leftist Reading Hour, for the curious or the committed, for a post-capitalist future and present. I'm wearing a Green Party button because I'm talking Green Party issues, making a case for minor party activism itself, particularly from the Green Party and our presumptive, the only thing I'm going to be presumptuous about our candidate, Howie Hawkins. There are other candidates. Maybe I'll go over talking about them. I think when we do the Green New Deal, they'll be mentioned and such. They're just not the established campaigners that Howie is, so they just have shortcomings in that way. And they spent the first, like last year, the opening campaign attacking him, saying he has unfair advantages. Well, I think his advantage is that he's an established Green Party activist who's been around for 30 years. So I guess that's unfair if you're just getting into it or you've been in a Green Party activist for 5 years and you just don't have that big social network. Check out the live stream on Facebook page, Three Left Show. Okay, so for the rest of the hour, most of the hour, I have another thing to read. It's basically Howie's response to the letter from Noam Chomsky and other left-wing academics. Many I like, many enjoy, and I respect their opinion, but just not on strategy. They're really great at talking about socialism and just mindsets and ideology. Hell, we wouldn't be able to have a conversation about how the ruling class influences our opinions without Chomsky. He's essential, even for those that aren't as radical as me. So it hurts a little. It hurts a little when he says that the activism you're doing just is getting in the way. But here is his very recent, very fresh response. Every state is a battleground. Howie Hawkins' response to an open letter to the Green Party about the 2020 election strategy. I was just completing a response to the first version of Michael Albert's An Open Letter to the Green Party, which was called Dear Howie Hawkins, Green Sense and Nonsense, at the earlier part of the month, when the new open letter reached me. So I respond to this group version instead. I doubt that we are going to persuade each other at this point. After all, I have been back and forth with many of the people expressing these opinions in previous elections on the Safe States proposal. The signers want the Green Party presidential ticket to campaign only in safe states where the outcome is a foregone conclusion, and support the Democratic presidential ticket in battleground states where the race will be close between the two ruling party candidates. Michael Albert was one of the early proponents of that approach in 2004 with his article Election Plan, August 2003. I wrote several responses at the time to the safe state strategy advocated by Michael and others, including signers of this open letter. After the election, I compiled many of those statements in the book Independent Politics, Green Party Strategy Debate, published by Haymarket in 06. Some of us had another exchange in June 2016 on the question, Michael Albert wrote, we need a united left. Bill Fletcher replies on left unity, and then Howie responded with his own response. Keep, are you keeping track? Let's see. I took notes on, because I did actually peruse those articles as well. Pretty much, so it's called We Need a United Left. And Albert's case was that a united left is one that works contextually and supports the best possible outcome, which in his argument was a Clinton presidency. Okay. But just to point out that these arguments have occurred before every time. So it's kind of why they haven't let go of this Green Party is a spoiler, or that we hurt the Democrats by running. I laid out with that other article why that isn't the case, and how he revisits it and expands on them. Their open letter response to my article, The Green Party is Not the Democrats' Problem, that I published in Christmas of last year, conflates what I said in my article with what they claim Jill Stein and the Green Party said in 2016. Jill and other Greens may want to respond for themselves, but I will respond here with my views speaking for myself. What is different this time around? Well, the two capitalist party system stranglehold on U.S. politics has not changed. The safe state strategy, the open letter writers advocate, does not challenge that stranglehold. It accepts it as a given. They argue that Trump is what is different this time around. He's a special danger. We have heard that many times before with Goldwater, Nixon, Reagan, and the Bushes. Part 1. The left can't outsource fighting the right to the Democrats. So his major arguments is that our opponents kind of in the left, or rather our critics is fair, they're using the same old arguments that go back literally 100 years. We fight the right better than the Dems do. The Dems themselves enable the right because they are center-right. And I'm going to add and preface that you can't ironically be something. In recent years, like the most strongest possible like example is you have these chuds, these edgy teenagers who are ironically Nazis. Like they're not really neo-Nazis, they're not really racist, but they're going to use racist rhetoric, they're going to use neo-Nazi symbols, they're going to like engage and show up on neo-Nazi platforms, but they're all doing it to be edgy and mess with people they consider boring and square and make fun of people. It's like, oh, you're taking me seriously when I say like we should have a we should kill all the blacks? What? How silly of you! You're ridiculous. I'm so funny. Now that's an extreme example, but it also carries that you can't ironically be something. When the argument is, we're going to run as Democrats as left-wingers, and we're going to use the ruling party platform to do good things, that carries the same logic to me as, we're going to ironically be Democrats, center-right, to do what we want, to pass our agenda. I think that's unsensible. So reading Howie's response. They say Greens refuse to recognize the special danger of Trump, and that Greens say that there is no difference between the Democrats and Republicans. Now granted, there's a lot of rhetoric about how there's no difference between Democrats and Republicans. I played my number 3 intro, which includes Lewis Black, comedian Lewis Black, with his bit about how, so the two-party system is a bowl of crap looking in the mirror. Now, despite this rhetoric, which to me is a bit hollow, as well as other kind of calls and all those other, that 40% of voters that want a minor party, they want to join something, they never do. They never form their own minor party. They treat voting like buying toothpaste. They're waiting for some other entity to create it. It's like, oh, I so want this product. And boom, the market has provided it. That's not how politics works. Because banks don't bankroll minor parties. They bankroll the parties that do their bidding. So a minor party that people want that isn't monopolistic, that does work for them, it has to have ground support. So I feel a little hollow when, say, Lewis Black will say that the Democrats and Republicans are the same, but he, and certainly his values align with the Green Party, he's certainly left-leaning. Why hasn't he joined a workers' party? Why doesn't he campaign with Greens? Or at least just come out as Viggo Mortensen, actor Viggo Mortensen, said he was going to vote for Jill Stein. A simple omission of that is a left support. To at least signal to me that you're serious. Otherwise, it's just all a joke to say, yeah, they're both the same, but I'm not going to do anything about it. Just nihilistic, not vote at all. Or keep voting for the Democrat. After all, they are the lesser evil. Okay, quite a tangent there. I did not say in any article of my own, how he says, nor in 2016, or ever, that Trump was not a special danger. In my view, Trump's racism, corruption, and narcissistic sociopathy make him and not just a man with bad policies, but a bad man. Orange man bad. He was the greater evil compared to Clinton. He's a greater evil than previous Republican presidents. He is an ever-present danger right now in office. What is different about Trump from previous Republicans is his vicious public scapegoating, which has given permission for increased covert discrimination by institutional gatekeepers and has triggered open slurs, vandalism, and violence by white supremacists, or nationalists, against immigrants, Muslims, Jews, people of color, LGBTQ, and women. Recognizing the danger of Trump does not mean that electing any damn Democrat should trump all other considerations. The Democrats might beat Trump, but they won't beat Trumpism. The Democrats should have crushed Trump in a landslide in 2016 because the hard right, regardless of what the Green Party was doing, because the hard right Republicans he reflects are a shrinking political minority. That's why all of the standard Republicans have to fall in line with Trump. They don't have a political base to depend on anymore. No one wants to actually vote for them. Like, conservatives vote for them in their states because they see them as a lesser evil compared to Democrats. That's how messed up it is. Everyone is in the same mindset. And they gotta get out of it. But in the U.S., but Democrats have lost many state governments and federal offices to Republicans, you know, which help keep the right in power even though their base is shrinking. In office, the Democrats join the Republicans to support basic policies of the capitalist class that they care about. This is economic austerity at home and neocon imperialism abroad. Most working people don't vote because neither major party is credible to them on issues of peace and prosperity. Instead of depending on the soft right Dems to fight the hard right Republicans, the most effective way to fight the right is to build an independent left movement and party with its own program, its own actions, its own candidates. That is the priority of my presidential campaign. It's the same logic I use in doing my show in this community radio station. It's not ours unless it's ours. Our own radio station, our own media, our own journalism. Why are we depending on Hearst? Why are we depending on Megacorps to deliver information to us? We can't trust them. No one does. As I campaign, I discuss the differences between the two parties and the extreme danger of Trump. So we're not, Howie himself is not doing the, they're both the same, so whatever. That's what other people say. There are all kinds of people online and in public who say these things. And they're not totally wrong, but yeah, it's not nuanced enough either. But Howie and other Greens aren't that. That's putting words in our mouth to say we're all saying the they're both the same, so whatever. We draw distinctions between the Dems and Trump. I point out that Sanders is far closer to the Greens on many issues than all the rest of the Dems. See example, his own article, Which Green New Deal? Recognizing these distinctions does not lead me to support one capitalist party over another, or to support Sanders, who is recruiting independent socialists and progressives into said major party. He is misrepresenting socialism as New Deal liberalism. He is again committed to supporting whoever the Democratic nominee is, setting himself up for a repeat of 4 years ago. One difference among the Democrats is that the corporate wing will not commit to returning the favor to support Sanders. Just as Obama has made it known that he is opposed to Sanders' nomination, Hillary Clinton recently and very publicly refused to say whether she would support Sanders if he is the nominee. The signers of this letter seem to have bigger problems inside the Dem Party than they do with Greens. Their safe state strategy wants the Green Party to accept the same powerless relationship of one-way collaboration with the Democratic Party that the corporate Democrats want from Sanders progressives. You have to support us, but we're not going to support you. Indeed, the Democrats do all they can to keep Greens off the ballot and out of candidate forums and debates. They basically smear Greens as candidates groomed by Russians and Republicans, as Clinton recently did to Jill Stein on the former Obama campaign manager David Plouffe's podcast. That's the one referenced before where she said Tulsi Gabbard is a Russian asset too. And Stein definitely was. Definitely. All because of a picture in Moscow. Jesus Christ. Trump's racism is nothing new. The Republicans have been mobilizing around the white backlash to black civil rights since Goldwater. They mobilize resentment against many targets. All people of color, immigrants, Muslims, women, queer, and peace environmental advocates. Even if they themselves are conservative. As soon as you start opposing pipelines, you're on the other team, the enemy. The Democrats have taken for granted the support of these targets of scapegoating while delivering very little for them. Between elections, the Democrats don't fight the Republicans. They collaborate with them on economic and foreign policies, which leaves social policies as the thing that we care about, or the only thing we're allowed to care about. Crime. That's criminal. Part two. Independent left politics is more powerful. So here's the case for doing things not that way. The signers note that I say in my article that the Greens want to get Trump out as much as anybody. Then they ask, how can it be that if Greens would vote for a Green candidate and not for Sanders, Warren, or any Democrat in a contested state, knowing that doing so could mean a Trump victory? Well, that can be because there are stronger ways to fight Trump than waiting for the Democrats to beat Trump in the 2020 election. Trump is dangerous now. The Democrats should have impeached him long ago. So here's Howie's tongue-lashing about impeachment. He's not a Russiagator. There were people on the left he was criticized. It's actually what his opponents in the Green Party primary are basically like. Their line of attack is he's a Russiagator because he believes that Trump should be impeached. I think that's weird. But here's this case. This case that doesn't depend on Russiagate at all. It really doesn't. They had a chance at the end of this first year in office when Representative Al Green of Texas introduced articles of impeachment for Trump's racist statements, actions, and policies. Only 58 Democrats supported him. It is no accident that the majority of representatives who called for Trump's impeachment were Asian, Black, and Latino, until the summer of last year. The Democratic Speaker of the House, Pelosi, kept saying impeachment would be divisive while Trump was deliberately dividing the nation every day with his policies and provocations. Trump was committing crimes in plain sight from the moment he took office. He also should have been impeached for corrupt self-enriching, allowments, nepotism, campaign finance felonies, inciting violence by white nationalists, other atrocities against migrants at the border, war crimes, like every president, gutting federal regulations and agencies, constant obstruction of justice. Instead, the Dems have belatedly chosen to go small instead of big by impeaching him on the Ukraine extortion scheme and cover-up, as if all his other crimes are acceptable. Instead of beating Trump up politically on multiple grounds for a protracted period of time, the Democrats have given Trump a short Senate trial peppered with militaristic messaging in support of the U.S. proxy war with Russia in Ukraine. Because truly, Trump's crime here is that he was undermining that effort. The Democrats' short, narrow, and often jingoistic impeachment, you know, that he's a traitor to the country, traitorous, that's Trump's crime. It's not the war crimes. It's not starving migrants at the border. It's undermining war with Russia. This trial fails to show the people, generally the public, how Trump's crimes hurt them as workers, consumers, minorities, and women. How he's undermined peace, The trial does none of that, right? The argument with the trial is that he's a traitor and he undermines our foreign policy. This does not make Trump into the bad guy to Americans. He's the bad guy to the military-industrial complex. He's the bad guy to the deep state. This is not undermining him. That's the argument. Now, this is typical for how Democrats enabled Trumpism itself. Democratic support for bipartisan militarism abroad enabled Trump to successfully appeal to voters who want to end the endless wars, although that was, of course, a big lie. Decades-long Democratic support for pro-corporate economic policies has created the growing economic inequality and insecurity that has provided the backdrop for Trump and the Republicans to expand their base among downwardly mobile whites with racist, xenophobic, misogynistic scapegoating. Previous Democratic administrations refused to prosecute corporate criminals who stole 14 million homes or the war criminals who tortured people. It boils my blood whenever I just think of Obama just shrugging his shoulders and saying, "We tortured some folks." That was the end of it. And that's your hero? The lesser evil. Okay. See, the Democrats left them walking free and they walked right into the Trump administration. Right? All these cast of villains. They should have been in jail. Why are they in jail? For some details of this, see my own article, The Rich White Man's Justice System Protects Trump and His Cronies. The Democrats have helped to normalize Trump by joining with him to overwhelmingly vote for 3 consecutive increases to the Pentagon budget, including more than he has even asked for. They join with him to enact the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement, the new NAFTA. They joined with Trump in their silence or cheerleading for the prosecution of Julian Assange, persecution of Chelsea Manning, and another Espionage Act case that threatens the press freedom of every news organization because they all depend on leaks to get the news about what the government is actually doing. The left will be more powerful if it makes its demands independently, and here's the meat, of either pro-corporate, pro-war party. That is what it did in the anti-Vietnam War movement. We demanded out now to every politician. So this is how his direct personal experience, because just like Bernie, he was there. And it's Bernie's experience. It's why he's been an independent all of his career. Demands, the agenda, nothing less. We didn't shut down our demonstrations and dilute our slogans to support Eugene McCarthy and Robert Kennedy, who were calling for negotiations rather than immediate withdrawal. Some did go clean for Gene or for RFK, but the anti-war movement in the streets said there would be nothing to negotiate. We kept our demand out now. That set the agenda, not in the negotiations now position of Johnson and Humphrey as well, as McCarthy and McKennedy that they had. We did not say, wait until November to vote for the lesser evil. By making its demands independently, the anti-Vietnam War movement remained strong and clear in its demand. We now know that we stopped Nixon's secret plan to end the war using nuclear weapons against North Vietnam, with a link to that in this article. The Vietnam Memorandum and mobilization demonstrations of millions in October and November of 69 convinced Nixon to back off or face popular backlash that would destroy his presidency. Perhaps in 68 we drew the lesson from 64, when the SDS's slogan of part of the way with LBJ captured the sentiment of most of the left. They got what they wanted. LBJ won. He immediately and massively escalated the war. We lost the war on poverty in the jungles of Vietnam. Compare 68 to 2004, when anybody but Bush took hold in the anti-Iraq war movement. I was a teenager at the time, personally. United for Peace and Justice adopted the slogan, against the Bush agenda. Not the war agenda, Bush agenda. Which, as a young man, I took as everything that's wrong is the Bush administration. So when Obama won, I was expecting the Bush administration to be overturned. The Bush agenda, right? None of it was overturned. Only little snippets of it via executive order. Easily overturned by Trump. Continuing. So against the Bush agenda meant vote for pro-war Kennedy, the lesser evil who said that he could fight the war better than Bush. After Kerry's loss, the anti-war movement was disoriented. It could mount little protest as the Democratic speaker, still then Nancy Pelosi, working with her Republican counterpart, made sure that the supplemental war budgets were voted through in the spring so that the Iraq war funding would not become a campaign issue that fall. After Obama was elected in 08, most of the anti-war movement went home, even though Obama's continued the old wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and got into new ones in Libya, Syria, and Yemen. What changed was Obama's wars were less visible. He replaced many U.S. ground troops in direct combat roles with local proxies, contracted mercenaries, drone assassinations, jet fighter strikes, and special ops. Cool stuff. The progressive left continued to that demobilization in the anti-war movement by saying the most important thing was to elect a Democratic president instead of independently advancing its own demands to both parties. So voting blue no matter who. What do we get? Less harm? I need a case for that. That isn't some equivocation. Okay, now for some nuts and bolts. Okay, so this is the kind of part of the response which is like, do you know what we're dealing with here? Like, we're like knee deep in excrement here. And it's also, the next part is the case that the center, you know, the Democrats, they fight the left as much as the right. We're fighting both parties. And joining one of them, so they're not directly fighting you, is, well, to be blunt, the coward's way out. Like I was kind of saying before, like, you're working for them. You're helping them, and you get nothing in return. Only that you are not being attacked. So I guess that's what you get. You get, you're not being directly oppressed. Well, that's fine if you're an academic, if you have a good career, if you're middle class. But that doesn't help all the people that are oppressed either way, that aren't in opposition to the status quo, but trampled by it. The signers of the open letter say that after the summer, the Green Party presidential ticket can easily abandon its campaign in the battleground states. It is not easy. It is not even possible. By that time, the Green ticket will already be on the ballot. It is too late by then to get off the ballot. So, kind of ignoring of the rules and how campaigns are done and how our election system actually works. That's usually ignored, or it's just the kind of ignorance that it's not mentioned. It's a mistake. It's just a mistake, an oversight. No, nothing malicious behind it. I'm not being sarcastic. It's just a mistake to just like, I don't understand the election system. I'm going to tell you how you should be interacting with it. The Green Party part of its existence is interacting with the election system. And basically figuring out or encountering just how terrible it is. Let's go into how. But first, strong questions in response to their questions. Which states will be the contested states? The open letter says 10. Many analysts say closer to 15. Some states will go in and out of contested status with the ups and downs of the polls during the campaign. How do the safe states strategists determine now which of the states the Greens are supposed to stay off the ballot? Any candidate seeking the Green presidential nomination who refused to petition a campaign in the 20-30% of those states might be contested, who might be, would not get the Green nomination at the convention. Because generally, our criteria for who is the Green Party presidential candidate is, are they a good campaigner? Are they campaigning? Are they campaigning in a lot of places? At least that's my criteria. The reason why Howie's competition, inter-party competition, I want to support them, but they're not doing enough. They're not campaigning as hard or as many places as Howie. I think they're attempting to. But here's where it becomes just unfair, with just on how unfair our election system is. Howie has advantages. He's older. He has more experience. He has more people helping him. He's a veteran fundraiser. The others aren't. They have the same chutzpah. They have good platforms. Some of them have great charisma. probably even more than Howie. But there's an inequality, and that sucks. It sucks. It sucks in any election race. It sucks all across the board. It's our entire system. It's our entire society. It sucks. Trying to change it. The signature and other requirements to get Green Party candidates, or rather any minor party candidates, on the ballot are off the charts more difficult in the U.S. than in any other electoral democracy in the world. The Green Party is qualified for the ballot in 20 states and D.C. Greens are now petitioning to get over 1 million signatures needed to get safely on other 30 states as well. Greens who knock themselves out, you know, work themselves hard, petitioning to qualify the Green Party for their state ballot, are not going to abandon their campaign in the fall, especially when ballot access for the next election cycle depends on the Green presidential vote in that state. So this is where an attack on our, you know, campaign in every state kind of strategy, which should be a no-brainer. It's what Clinton didn't do in 2016. That contextual voting isn't unifying the left because it is anti-green. It is excluding what we're doing. Because we need to build opposition everywhere. It's saying the people in these contested states, which again is debatable which states are contestable or not, Georgia is now considered a swing state based on the 2018 Abrams-Kemp gubernatorial contest and 2020 presidential polling. Georgia has some of the most restrictive ballot access laws in the country. While Democrats and Republicans do not have to petition on the ballot, Green candidates must submit tens of thousands of signatures. 1% of voters for statewide office, 5% for district offices. And he goes into the details in all of that. All these rules were put in place to keep the Communist Party, then in the 40s, the major minor party, off the ballot, which was more about keeping African Americans from voting. Because at the time, Democratic primaries were all white, and the Republican lily-white factions being challenged by African-American Double V for Victory campaign against fascism abroad and segregation at home. Now, who out there know about the Double V for Victory campaign? I think I've heard of it before, but in passing. If the 2020 Green presidential ticket gets a vote of 1% of registered voters, the Georgia Green Party will get minor party status and enable them to put up statewide candidates and, you know, continue to fight and be in opposition, an actual opposition in Georgia. Pennsylvania is a battleground state by all accounts. The Green ticket will need 2% of the vote to secure a ballot line for the next election cycle. For Greens in Pennsylvania, the state is indeed a battleground. It's a constant battle with Democrats as well as Republicans. Greens are fighting the Democrats over fracking and the hundreds of miles of new gas pipelines to supply the proposed Appalachia Storage and Trading Hub, a massive petrochemical infrastructure complex that will lock us into decades of fracked gas and oil as feedstock for the production of plastic that is not biodegradable. They have long battled the Democrats in Philadelphia, who have partnered with state Republicans to close dozens of public schools and replace them with charter schools. Pennsylvania Greens don't want to sacrifice their ability to actually oppose these things against pro-fracking, pro-charter Dems for another election cycle. If we went through every state, safe or battleground, in the 2020 presidential election, we would find every one of them is a battleground for the Green Party. Now, close aside, in language, Howie uses the Green Party because he's talking about Greens. Green activists is who he talks to. I'm a bit broader than that. I think you could substitute the mention of Green Party in this article, if it's not including elections themselves, for an independent left, or just the left. The left needs to be its own thing. It needs to be oppositional to the rest of the political spectrum, right? Now, not in the kind of opposition like we want to kill them all, or we gotta, like, destroy them, or, like, we gotta dominate and be authoritarian. But as far as, like, we need to, like, have our own side, right? I mean, we feel like you gotta, one of the basics of communication is to advocate for yourself, to know what your needs are, and To do otherwise is to be in an abusive relationship, which many consider their relationship to the Democratic Party as. So, part three, for Greens, all states are battleground states. The safe states are not safe for Greens. So here's where, and this, but again, substitute Greens for the left, right? That's what I'm doing in my head because that's what we're talking about here. That's what Howie's talking about. He's just putting in the context of the election and Green Party. But to me, the Greens are sidelined, like Michael Brooks and Sam Cedar. They're so dismissive. They're jokers. They're comedians first, I guess. I don't know, but like it hurts. It angers me the way they talk out divisively about basically independent left strategy. They just constantly harangue about the need to work with the Democrats. It's their only game in town. But at the same time, they'll also say we need to do all the other independent organizing stuff, as if these things don't conflict. But they do. Examples. The safe states are not safe for Greens. Take Michael Albert's safe state of Massachusetts. In 98, citizens petitioned to put an initiative referendum on the ballot for public campaign financing that won in a landslide, 60% to 30%. The overwhelmingly Democratic legislature refused to fund it. That was the last straw for a former Reform Democrat who became a Green named Jill Stein. Or take my safe state of New York. The Democrats just enacted a law designed to kill third parties in New York by increasing the vote needed to maintain ballot status by 2.5 times and tripling the petition signatures needed to get back on the ballot should one lose it. That includes the Working Families Party, the Greens, and now the Libertarians. There's also the Conservative and the Independence Party. Now, when asked about this, you know, the Dem leadership says, well, we just want to go after the fake parties, Working Families, Conservative, and Independence, because they just cross-endorse, right? They rarely run their own people. They do sometimes. Now, that is hollow, enraging rhetoric, because they're not targeting fake parties. They're targeting all parties that aren't the Democrats, making New York truly a one-party state. Is this democracy? Is this fairness, justice? Is this friendship? And this is not just an attack on minor parties. It is an attack on the left, because it's basically saying that if you want to get anything done, you have to run in our center-left party. Because when it comes to the leadership, that's what they are. And there's a assumption we can replace them as progressive Dems or as a left-wing Dems. And it's not how it works. It's not how it's ever worked. We'll continue. Examples. On affordable housing issues, Greens are fighting Dems in every state and city they control. The Dems are thick as thieves of their banker and real estate developer campaign donors in escalating rents, gentrifying, displacing, as well as homelessness. As Trump himself was with the Democratic machine in New York before he ran for president. Greens in every state are fighting Democrats every day, and by Greens, the left, on fracking, oil and gas pipelines, single payer, gentrification, displacement, public school support, living wages, police brutality, on and on. Greens, the left, want a presidential candidate who campaigns. Rather, the Greens want for the left a presidential candidate who campaigns in their states in support of their local candidates and causes. They want to vote for a Green presidential alternative to the two-party system of corporate rule. Only Stein went to Standing Rock. For the Greens, all 50 states and the D.C. are battlegrounds. The signer safe states proposal asks Greens in 20 to 30% of the country to campaign for the same party that they are fighting every day. They want us to tell voters with a straight face to vote Green down ticket, but Democratic at the top of it. Of course, in every one of those down ticket races, Green candidates are attacked by Dems as a spoiler who is splitting their votes. Greens splitting the Democratic vote is what the signers claim the Greens did in 2016 when they say that if Stein had not run in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, Clinton would have won. That is not really true. CBS polling asked Stein voters who they would have voted for if the ballot only had been Clinton or Trump. 60% said they would have stayed home. 25%, a quarter, said they would vote for Clinton. 14% for Trump. Run those numbers for Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, and you find that Trump still would have won all three states. Of course, there are unlikely scenarios where the Green vote could be the margin of difference in the presidential race. The signers are asking the Green Party to campaign for Dems when they haven't even tried to defend their own vote or correct rampant election irregularities. Now let's get into how what losers the Democrats are in defending democracy and the integrity of our elections. In 2000, Al Gore called off demonstrations to continue the recount in Florida after the U.S. Supreme Court stopped the recount and appointed Bush. A consortium of news organizations did a thorough statewide recount and found that Gore had won Florida after all. In 2004, after Kerry refused to contest voter suppression, voting machine problems, and other irregularities in Ohio, it was the Green candidate then, David Kopp, who spearheaded a recount in Ohio that led to a U.S. House Judiciary Committee report that exposed the wide disenfranchisement of Black and Latino voters and to reforms in a few states. What are Dems doing about this? Nothing. Nothing. The same thing happened in 2016. So basically, this is an argument that he's not quite making explicitly, but it's been made by other Greens and himself in the past, that if you don't want the Greens to be a spoiler, then reform the elections. Make them fair. Make them not first past the post. Make them a ranked choice ballot. Make them with runoffs. You know, make it so that the spoiler argument is truly moot, not applicable. Do they do any of that? No. Do they make elections fair so that whoever you are, you can run fairly? No, they don't. They do nothing. Do they even make the election systems accountable? No, they do nothing. That's what angers me when they say what I'm doing is wrong. Green Party shouldn't exist. Green Party isn't ineffective, irrelevant, right? We're both simultaneously irrelevant and have no impact, and we're not fighting any fight. We're not being in opposition. In fact, we're helping Republicans. But at the same time, we're also costing the election. So it's, you know, twists and turns. Same thing happened last cycle. The Stein campaign sought recounts in the battleground states Clinton lost to its, and they exposed voting regularities. There are times where during the recount, Clinton had more votes than the original count. Stein went, like in some counties, went from zero votes to hundreds of votes. There were votes that were just not being counted. Our lawsuits, Green Party lawsuits, did that. Some Russian asset actually investigating our voting irregularities. That's not something the Dems do. That's something the opposition does. The left. A left that fights for itself. And I think that's the title of a Zero Books publication called A Left for Itself. You know, beyond just the performative feel-good voting and activism, which is sort of a projection what is said about Greens. Real solutions. The signers claim voting Green in the swing state is a feel-good activity, as if fear of climate disaster, for example, shouldn't be a motivator in political action. That's quoting Chomsky from the letter. I think I skipped that part. This is condescending and disrespectful to say that Greens are political dilettantes who cast votes just to feel good. We vote to advance our program of system change. We don't waste our vote affirming Democrats like Clinton personified the elite consensus of neoliberal economics and neocon imperialism. The climate crisis is a prime reason why Greens don't support Democrats. The last Democratic administration above all the above energy policy was a euphemism for fracking the hell out of the country. Obama still brags about how the U.S. has become the world's largest oil and gas producer. He brags about it. Clinton, as Secretary of State, promoted fracking globally. She had her delegates in the DMC vote against all climate policies proposed by Bill McKibben, a major activist, on behalf of the Sanders campaign. The one Sanders plank that was adopted was, of course, 2 years later, reversed, which recommitted the party to taking fossil fuel industry money and went back on the record for all of the above energy. The language that Sanders and McKibben got through their, you know, inside out strategy was removed. Gone. Like they never did it. Wasted effort. You say my wasted effort is wasted? I'm seeing a lot of wasted effort on your part too. Trump calls climate change a hoax, but the Democrats act like it's a hoax. The signers continue saying real solutions require Trump out of office. Real solutions will become far more probable with Sanders and Warren in office. Real solutions will become somewhat more probable, whatever that means, with the likes of Biden in office. Yes, let's be realistic. The Democrats are not going to bring us Medicare for All, Green New Deal, deep cuts and war, or national popular vote for president with ranked choice voting. Medicare for All, in four states now, Hawaii, California, Vermont, and last year here in New York, after Democratic state legislators passed single-payer legislation when they did not control both houses and the governor. When they did, single-payer could have been enacted, but they stopped supporting it. When Obama convened a very public summit to discuss healthcare options in March 09, the lead sponsor of the Expanded and Improved Medicaid for All Act, Connors, made a personal request to Obama to attend. Obama said no, until relenting at the last minute after much protest. The bill that became the Affordable Care Act was drafted by insurance industry hacks in a Democrat-controlled Senate committee. And it goes on and on and on about how the Dems, just even when elected, do not advance solutions. And the left is continuing to not advance solutions either. Does it help the left to have a Democratic president in office? I'm not sure. I don't have a definitive yes or no. Does it hurt the left to have a Republican in office? I don't think so. I don't. My conclusion is it doesn't matter. Whether it's a Democratic president or a Republican president, the left has to be its own thing if it's going to advance its platform. If community activists, you know they have to act independently and put the pressure on the Democrats on their city council. There's always a lesser evil. You know, he goes back all the way to the interwar years, you know, makes a powerful lesser evil argument, no lesser evil. There's always a lesser evil. As you mentioned in the beginning, you know, every Republican president before they were elected was a great danger that needed to be prevented. And when a dangerous Republican is prevented, what happens? Does the country move leftward? No, neoliberalism continues. Austerity continues. The Obama administration committed to austerity. They did it. They did it because of the crash caused by the Bush administration. But let's freaking face it. There was no Democratic opposition to subprime lenders. There was no Democratic opposition to deregulating the banks. The bank deregulations occurred in the Clinton administration. It's a continuity. There's a continuity between administrations. There's a continuity in our political system. There's a continuity in everything. All is one. One is all. Getting philosophical here, but you need some good philosophy. Well, damn it. I've reached the end of the show. Let's jump to the last paragraph. We are running out of time to address the life or death issues of the climate crisis. The nuclear arms race, the growing economic inequality. That will become a survival issue for working people, whose life expectancies are now declining. We don't have time to march in place with a safe state strategy to elect a lesser evil Democrat. If the Democrats again give us a dismal choice between a corporate Dem and Trump and lose again because they cannot get their natural base to vote for them, it will be their fault, not the fault of a left. A left for itself. Or, in this case, the Greens. This is Dan Platt. I am a Green Party member because I am a lefty. And I'm proud to say it. I don't hide. I don't obfuscate. Okay, I'm going to go over to do my housekeeping because I want to tell you guys how to get in contact with me. I have social media, both on Twitter and Facebook. Three Left Show. The Three Left Show, I think it's just Three Left Show. Numeral Three Left Show. The website, which is an archive for all previous episodes, this will be 67, is threelefts.news, nothing else. I have a Patreon if you'd like to materially support the show. When things are set up here, We will have a membership drive, so keep that on your mind, that this radio station needs members, just as organizations that actually support you and work for you also need your membership. It is not like buying toothpaste. It is not like you donate once and, well, they'll remember me. They'll fight for me. Or I'm giving them money because I support what they're doing. That's a one-way relationship. And there's no love, solidarity, or continuity there. And we need to avoid that in the future. That is why a community radio station, community ownership, community governance, that is what we need to do moving forward. That's what the Green Party is for. It's what we would do if given power. So with that, thank you very much for listening. I'll just throw it. There are more the cover, more responses, more or less. One is a deeper one that, you know, we're fighting for system change and electing a lesser evil doesn't do that. And there's other responses from Black Agenda Radio. So these are particularly left-wingers who are black, giving their take and how many of them are registering Dem to vote for Bernie, but will go back to Green as soon as their primary is over. And I know many people who are doing that. There are many Green activists doing that, actually. So when I first heard of that a few times, I was actually a little disheartened because I didn't plan to. But now I'm wondering if I'm going to feel left out when the New York primary comes around. I don't know. But it's kind of not what I'm worried about right now. There's a lot more to work on, doing a lot of other projects. I might be joining the band this year. I might be doing more documentaries.